Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, today joined by Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, Nick. Good to be joining you and Terence. I haven't seen you either of you for a while.
Indeed, very good to have you back with us. We are also, of course, joined today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing?
It's afternoon that shows the weather shifting. One can't, it's Friday, one can't be too cynical right now.
No, well said. I do have the unpopular view that I kind of despise spring, but that's just me. But I think all sensible people would be very pleased by today's lovely spring weather. Anyway, let us get into the news of today. And a first story we've got to talk about is the kind of what seems to be a growing scandal connecting the Justice Minister. Minister Thembi Simelane to essentially a dodgy loan, which originally came from VBS Bank. So it seems it's not just the EFF who are embroiled in the VBS Bank fallout. The Hawks have executed a search and seizure warrant on Justice Minister Thembi Simelane's former personal assistant based at the Polokwane municipality last week to secure possible evidence of corruption linked to the municipality's 349 million rand investment with VBS Mutual Bank in 2017 and 2016. The Justice Minister was the mayor of the municipality between 2014 and 2021, right when the association with VBS Bank happened, and she became the ultimate beneficiary of a VBS of VBS money when she got what is described in the News24 as a dubious half a million rand loan from a VBS fixer to buy a coffee shop in Sandton. The Justice Minister has been defending herself in Parliament today, I believe, talking about these things, saying that no, she's definitely still going to be investigated. It's not up to her whether she gets investigated or not, even though she's the Justice Minister. And the Justice Committee was saying that it's going to hold her to account. We shall have to see. But this is kind of all a little bit besides the point. Michael, I think, not that it's particularly surprising that she hasn't resigned, but it's very clear to me that if you're a minister with serious allegations against you, where basically the media is accusing you, and says that they have documents to prove it, even though you haven't been found guilty yet, you should probably resign. And that goes doubly when you are in charge of the Justice Ministry. What do you make of this story?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Nicholas. I think it's it's the office that has to be protected, and that ought to be one of her first considerations. And I think one of the problems with this is we're talking about a relatively small sum here, considering the kinds of numbers that we've become so accustomed to. And one of the problems, in a way, is how ordinary this has become. It's been allowed. Corruption has been allowed to become quite an ordinary thing. It almost, a sum of 575,000 is not the stuff of headlines anymore. We're so used to millions and billions, and so this ordinariness is, in fact, a terrible problem. And one of the critical ways of actually reversing that, we as a society, we need to reverse the sense of ordinariness. It's always got to be an extraordinary thing, an outrageous thing, and one of the ways to do that, I think, is for very declarative and decisive political gestures, such as a sense that ministers must resign the minute there's any suspicion about their integrity, and or their probity, even if it is just a claim and allegation. It needs to become a convention that this is how we react. We react immediately and with alarm whenever there's the slightest indication of corruption of the sort, and especially, as you say, somebody in the cabinet and in a portfolio that is responsible for the interests of citizens, in fact, to have justice done to them and on their behalf. So this is a very critical member of the cabinet, a very critical portfolio, and I absolutely agree. Resignation ought to be the first step, and this doesn't preclude, of course, the due process and the proper investigation of these things. That we assume is get must take place, but the time has come where, if South Africa does really want to take itself seriously and turn the corner and live up to all the things that are said over and over year after year about corruption and how we're going to clean things up. This is exactly where we need to start. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you there, Nick.
So she's made a big fuss appearing before Parliament today, saying that no, I'm not going to influence the NPA, even though it's basically, within my department. I'm not going to have any influence over the prosecutorial decisions, and no one will be held to account, and there's some sort of or be punished for investigating me, and this is all like a great big firewall. But Terence, the thing I want to get on here is, this is beginning to reveal, I think, that just the continuing inertia within the ANC. So we've seen from many ANC leaders, foremost among them Fikile Mbalula, saying that we've messed up as the ANC. There's a reason that we've been pilloried by the public, why we've lost so much in the polls. It's because we've basically let so many things slide on corruption, and because we've been arrogant. And he's been talking about renewing the party. Former President Thabo Mbeki has been talking about how the party needs to regenerate itself, that it needs to hold corrupt people to account. The president has also made moves about this. And clearly there is a strong faction within the ANC that says that not holding people to account for corruption, not being focused on the electorate, having some bad ideas has been part of why the ANC finds itself in the weakened position it's currently in. And yet we have a justice minister who is facing very serious, very real allegations, and she's not stepping aside. Whether she is going to or not, clearly, this is the way things have been done up until now in the ANC. I think it's quite clearly a test right now of Ramaphosa's leadership that he should be pushing to either remove her from cabinet or to pressure her to resign and step aside. What do you make of this?
Well, I'm going to use one of my favorite phrases, that there's a lot of moving parts here. First of all, understand that corruption has been a part of the ANC for decades. It's not a like a 1994 thing. When you operate underground and on sort of shoestring budgets and whatever, you start to have to find creative ways around things. You had people coming into power who had essentially put their lives on hold for the liberation of the country, and therefore when they got the opportunity, they saw a lot of ground to make up for. And for the ANC, the unity of the party has always been, I would say, the defining and the motivating defining motivation behind their chosen courses of action. Ideally, what you would like to see is a combination of institutions that can process these things rapidly, so that there's not going to be an interminable temporal hiding place, where you can just sort of, oh well, the law must take its course, but I'll see you in 2035 or something. There is also some sort of suasion and some sort of political imperative to act. I think, unfortunately, we've become, in a sense, quite inured to the sort of thing. As you're saying, it's not a huge amount of money, all things considered. You'd say, well, at least she wasn't greedy. I mean, it's dreadful when you're thinking in those terms, but
Yeah, this is not quite like the cases of whiskey during the State Capture Commission or any of that madness. And yet, I think this is, in many ways, this is worse.
Look, I looked very deeply into the VBS matter at the time, and what struck me was just how crude it all was. This wasn't like there was some sort of Gordon Gekko and Wall Street, like interfacing this computer with that computer. It was just like the money was stolen. Like, it was that simple. And I thought, how do you do that? Where's the Bond villain sitting behind the scenes? No, there wasn't. There was a they had their transactions on a spreadsheet, and you had the auditors coming in, and like when the junior guy saw that there were problems here, his senior said, "Oh, don't worry about this," and then he released a report. I'm not joking, where he said,
I perform certain procedures. Doesn't favor the reader with knowing what these procedures were, but apparently you could do some procedures. Look, let me just put this up front. No one comes out of that report looking nice. It's a salutary reminder that the private sector can get up to all sorts of shenanigans itself. But yeah, you know, one would think that there would be some sort of understanding that I think maybe what's missing for our politics is a sense of shame. In South Korea, people kill themselves rather than go to court. In South Africa, you know, this just seems to be part of the occupational experience.
Yeah, I think South Korea has jailed two former presidents for corruption specifically, at least one, which better to not have your president commit corrupt deeds at all. But if they're going to, it's not a bad thing to jail them. Michael, to me, the real issue here is, you know, because there's been so much corruption in the ANC over so many years, it's just sort of generally expected. I mean, sort of read the comments on our show here, and everyone's kind of like rolling their eyes and saying, what do you expect? And I think that it's important to not just let Ramaphosa kind of float above this, as he often tries to do, and sort of, you know, slip through the cracks of the discussion and just disappear and not have to make any difficult decisions. This is his cabinet. He's promised all sorts of things. He's promised this is the real new dawn, not like the old new dawn, which he was supposed to bring in 2018, but this is the real one. Yeah. And he should be actually taking steps here to do something. And maybe he will, but he should have done it already. Any final thoughts?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there are two phrases that the two of you have used. One, your phrase, Dick, where you refer to continuing inertia. And one would have thought, you know, after the most recent election results, that there'd be little more a kind of sense of moment in the ANC. They speak about it, but now we need to see the action, and it's exactly that. It's the president taking action, decisive action, before there's any sort of suggestion in public that he should. It ought to become this impulse, an impulse to do the right thing. Needs to be visible. And then the other phrase was Terence's, this sense of shame, the absence of a sense of shame. And I think the costs of that are very, very great. I remember in the late 1990s, seeing this sitting in with the arms deal, with, you know, the party being content to see Tony Yengeni being put out to dry as the fall guy, but then taking him off to Polsmo on their shoulders. I think, as far as I remember, Dalai Omar was there. The Premier of the Western Cape was there to see him. And you know, it was quite a shocking moment to me, and probably not to enough other South Africans. And maybe that's the other aspect of the continuing inertia, which is the public one. You know, is that we. And, you know, to offer an excuse for this, in a sense, there's just been so much of it. We kind of punch drunk. People are punch drunk, and they're just trying to survive. But it does, unfortunately, when that sort of thing happens at that higher level, and there is that absence of shame, and there is that sense of inertia, that it does begin to provide to the rest of society a kind of implicit imprimatur. It's fine. You know, it's not really so bad. You don't even need to. You don't need the fancy stuff that Terence was referring to earlier, the reverse computers and fancy technology. You simply do it. You can get away with it, and somebody will forgive you, and, you know, life goes on. And that's, I mean, that is the horror of it. So, yeah, as a final thought, I absolutely agree with you. There needs to be very decisive, visible political action, and this is really what we would like to see the president and the cabinet doing under the present circumstances.
The justice minister is supposed to. Go ahead,
Terence. When it comes to action, I'd like to say, show me the money, but I suspect that in South Africa, that might not mean what it means in Hollywood movies.
The justice minister is supposed to be appearing around about now before the Integrity Commission of the ANC, one of the world's least effective organizations. But, you know, maybe this time will be different. We can only hope. Anyway, let's move on to our next story. And this, go ahead, Michael, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, this is one of the maddening things in South Africa. We have, you know, all the institutions and the names for things and the organizations and the committees and the, we even have the laws for it. And we trot out all these things, but they, we need them actually to do what they're meant to do. So human rights commissions and the integrity commissions and the who knows what. You know, we actually need these people to deliver on the mandate that they've supposedly been given to do exactly that. Anyway, just a final thought.
Yeah, no, exactly. The president can fire someone without waiting for a 400-page report that no one's going to read from Parliament.
Yeah.
Anyway. Let's move on to our next story, and this is a sort of it's a specific example, but it speaks to a much larger issue, and that is the continuing problem of non-payment of municipal services around the country. So recently, the DA mayor of Umgeni in KZN, the only municipality controlled by the DA in KZN, gave an interview to News 24 where he was talking about the electricity problems that have affected his municipality. The DA municipality has been in a conflict with the ANC-controlled district municipality. Rural municipalities are kind of bundled together as... local municipalities in the rural areas are bundled together in district municipalities, and these things kind of are supposed to cooperate together. Now, in Umgeni's case, the ANC controls the district, the DA controls the local. And this is causing some fights over the provision of electricity. The DA municipality says that the district municipality has not been providing proper electricity supplies to some parts of Umgeni, particularly Hilton, which is, of course, one of the fancy areas of Umgeni. The other thing that the mayor was talking about here, apart from complaining about that issue, was also this issue of non-payment. So we've seen so many examples around the country of where people just aren't particularly interested in paying their municipal bills. Now, some people will say, well, this is because so many South Africans are poor. But in most municipalities, I think in all municipalities, you can actually apply if you're considered very poor and indigent for exemption from municipal rates. And you get a certain amount of free electricity and free water per month if you do. But there's a lot of people who don't qualify for that or never bother to apply for it, who still continue to not pay their municipal bills. Mayor Papas said specifically, he had the phrase here, people in GTIs or polos, some even drinking Hennessy, but won't pay for services. And he says that this is causing a big problem for the municipality. He says that when the DA took over in 2021, ratepayers owed 218 million rand to the municipality in outstanding electricity and water rates. He's managed to reduce that only very slightly to 215 million rand. So he says they have a lot of work to do on that one. Michael, let me start with you. What do you make of these issues here? I mean, you know, Umgeni is in the news because it's a DA-controlled one, but there's so many municipalities across the country where this exact scenario plays out where sort of there's a kind of, I guess, a dysfunctional relationship between the state and people. People don't trust the state, and the state doesn't trust people to pay. And so kind of both try to screw each other. The state doesn't provide the services it's supposed to, and the people don't pay the funds they're supposed to.
Yeah, I mean, it's not unconnected with our previous discussion, I think, is, you know, there is the sense that you can get away with it if you're brazen enough and, you just soldier on. But I think certainly an important point to make is that, you know, once contempt sets in for public services, I think the first likely way that it's going to be expressed is in the unwillingness of people to pay or to try and, you know, get out of meeting their obligations. And so, but at the same time, as Mayor Pappas points out, this is a critical thing. I think there is a phrase somewhere in this piece where he sort of underlined the sort of crisis. He described the debt to the municipality as an existential threat, so, and I'm pretty sure it must be. If you simply run out of money, then everything collapses. So it is a critical thing. On the one hand, you have to deal with offenders. You have to try and tackle that. But on the other, you have to deliver. So to use Terence's phrase from earlier on, many moving parts. There are these two essential moving parts, I think, in this story. It doesn't make it easier for people like Pappas, who's trying to find solutions. And, you know, we're far down the road now. I think a lot of these kinds of problems have been allowed to slide. And now the difficulty of getting everything back on track is really very great. But there is no way of dodging it, I don't think. It is, as he puts it, an existential threat to institutions like municipalities. Ways have to be found to convince people to bring their side of the bargain. And, of course, the first step towards doing that is making sure that municipalities do their job. It speaks very directly to the report that Terence and Saragan produced last week on the public service, how to turn the public service around. This is what it comes down to. It's having the right people there who can do their jobs, can be seen to be doing their jobs, and who can be trusted and visibly so. And that has to be part of the step towards getting the public to do what's due from their side. Yeah.
So Terence, your thoughts on this? I mean, Michael's just already laid out, I think, how he would begin fixing the situation. Do you have anything to add? If you were made tomorrow the High Emperor of South Africa, how would you begin repairing this relationship between citizens and government, particularly when it comes to the provision of municipal services? And, you know, you need money to fix the electricity infrastructure, but people don't want to pay for the electricity infrastructure for a variety of reasons. But one of the reasons is that, you know, the system isn't being maintained. So how do you break this cycle?
Look, I think that you know, one can say this is literally the million rand question for South Africa. I remember back in, I think it was 1995, Joe Slobo, who was the housing minister, said that the so-called culture of non-payment was a struggle tactic. Now people are in charge of their own destiny, and that will go. Well, that was way too optimistic. And what they tried to do for the first couple of Emperor Terence does have a certain ring to it. What they tried to do in the 90s was this Masakane campaign. Now, the idea was Masakane apparently means let's build together. It wasn't just about encouraging people to pay. It was about getting people involved in the water committees and the safety committees and the ward committees and whatever, this grassroots democracy. Now, you know, I think that the problem is that there's a limit to how much purchase that has on a technocratic state. You know, when you have mass society, you need mass solutions. And that doesn't always, you know, allow for people to be intimately involved. And of course, you know, the fact that people had not been paying for a number of years, there's something a little counterintuitive about the chosen political representatives coming in and saying, now you've got to pay. It was, you know, just like, well, screw you guys. And unfortunately, you know, so what a recurrent theme has been this, that the debt grows, it becomes effectively politically unrecoverable, so no one wants to actually handle it. It gets written off. You know, we once had a problem here where our electricity was cut because of their mistake. And the technician who came to do it just sort of laughed. He said, yeah, you guys in the suburbs, you know, your problem is you pay. They wouldn't dare do this to me. You know, because we don't pay it. We're not interested. This was, did I mention this was the council's own contractor who came and said this to me. I don't know. I think this maybe comes down to being willing to take the political blows, which might well mean the end of your incumbency for a generation. And I don't see any appetite for doing that. Or maybe just look at it differently and say that all of these things will effectively become free at the point of service, but then they're going to be collected through some sort of general tax. You know, we raise VAT to 25% or something like that, and say. But that, you know, that does, of course, destroy the revenue base of local government. So yeah, I don't have an easy solution.
So if I may get a bit airy-fairy and philosophical here for a second, Michael, I think, this story and to some degree the previous ones speak to this issue in South Africa, I think that we all have, which is that people who follow the rules in South Africa often feel like suckers rather than virtuous people. So
I
much of our
feel.
society, unfortunately, you see, so much of our society, and I think this causes an enormous amount of social tension, kind of in every single dimension you could look at, whether it's race, class, age, suburb versus township, whatever, is that anyone who follows the rules and does what they're supposed to in this country almost always ends up feeling like they're being screwed in some way. Whereas those who, kind of break the rules or skirt things, feel like, they're just doing what everyone else is doing. We're kind of being carried along. And I think this is the big item thing that we actually need to turn around is that people who follow the rules should feel proud, and those who don't follow the rules should feel shame. And until that becomes a much more widespread thing in the country, everyone's just going to keep trying to screw the system. And you can have the best governance in the world, but if the population basically has this incredibly negative, nihilistic view of how society is supposed to work, I think you're going to only make very limited progress. So yes, a little bit airy fairy and pontificate-y there, but what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of room for that kind of thinking, I think, bringing attention to bear on these sort of key questions. I think one of the one good reason for optimism is the evidence recently of the penalties available at the ballot box, or the penalties that are delivered via the ballot box. And I think that's going to be a key thing. And I'm sure that it has shifted the mentality of most South Africans right across the board, from townships to suburbs, about agency. It just a little bit. There's a little sense, and I think it'll grow, that history is not preordained, that nobody's going to rule for 1,000 years, or until whatever the critical moment is. And that, the people actually do have an influence, and that there is a dynamic at work that gives them a role, gives them agency. And that if behavior does change, then it's possible to bring change, to create change in society. So that's perhaps equally philosophical, but I think it is an indication of the point that we've reached. We've got an entirely different kind of form of government because of it. So already there's, a measure of dynamism that wasn't here 6 months ago.
Indeed, and I think making making the system work, even if imperfectly, is definitely a very powerful step in making people feeling like sticking to the rules is actually the way to go. Okay, briefly, let's talk about our last story for today. And the DA, as well as a number of other organizations, have gone before the Western Cape High Court to challenge the appointment of former Judge President John Hlophe, who was, of course, one of the first judges in South Africa to be impeached. They are challenging his appointment to the Judicial Services Commission, which picks South African judges. Now, he was appointed, he's one member of this group. He was proposed by the MK party, and he received the support of the EFF, MK, and I believe the ANC as well. There was apparently a little bit of discomfort with this appointment in the ANC itself, but ultimately they decided to put him on because they were worried that some of their MPs might vote for him anyway, and they, as per usual, prioritized party unity over everything else. But obviously, I think morally speaking, that it's very clear that someone who is impeached as a judge by Parliament should not be then appointed by Parliament to choose the next group of judges. That being said, I'm not entirely sure if there is a strong legal argument here, and I think the court will have to decide that. But Michael, any thoughts on this briefly?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I did have some legal insight into your very last point, whether there's whether there's grounds for this, but I think in the popular mind, I'm sure, certainly among the supporters of the Democratic Alliance and other parties in the kind of opposition camp, I think it's quite clear to people who think about this carefully, or even just passingly, in fact, that there's a contradiction between having somebody who, you know, was found to be unfit to serve on the bench now helping to choose judges. It's such a jarring and such an obviously jarring contradiction. So good for the DA. I think, despite their being in the GNU with the ANC, and lots of people, I think, are watching the party very closely to see just how much it manages to retain its independence and its principles, while at the same time preserving the kind of joint government project. I think it's very good that it has been taken a lead in this and made this case. I think one of the lastingly positive things about South African society, perhaps, is the attention that the media continues to give to all these critical issues. All the stories we've dealt with this afternoon are kind of proof of this. But one hopes that this will continue, that we'll constantly be reminded of the kind of society we are, the kind of contradictions we're having to deal with, and the importance of confronting them. So, yeah.
Terence, any final thoughts for today?
We live with a constitutional system that was sort of based on the assumption that the lunatics would not be running the asylum. I'm sorry, that's the best way I can put it. One can say many things, and many things that are not complimentary about some of the people who were sniffing around our political system in 1994. But I think if you went, even to some of the biggest shysters who at least pretended to be honorable men, those of us who read our Shakespeare, and you said, hey, I'm telling you, in 2024, they will put the first impeached judge onto the body that oversees judges, they would have said, aish, no, that's ridiculous, you're being like Afro-pessimistic or, dystopian. And Geku Lankwans, no. But when you throw off all the safeguards, this is kind of what happens. I mean, if you deliberately go and like cut your brake cables, you mustn't be surprised when your car doesn't stop.
Yeah, I think for
Emperor Terence.
I think the ANC in particular was extremely short-sighted in doing this. Because I think there's an affection in the ANC for Floppe because he was seen to be a judge that was, quote unquote, on their side. In fact, I think Jesse Duarte actually said that once in an NEC meeting in defense of him. But, he's affiliated with MK now. The ANC thinks that he's going to do anything other than try and just screw them over through the judicial appointments from now until the end of time. They are being very naive. So, yeah, I mean, even from a completely self-interested point of view, never mind the morality of the whole thing, I think the ANC has been not very astute on this one. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We hope you found the show interesting, and we will see you next week. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone. Cheers.